Hi, this is Ben in Cochabamba, Bolivia. The climate conference which I've been attending has finished, and I find myself at a very lively party attended by people from all over the world. I have here Jim, who's going to maybe tell us a little about where we are. So where are we and what's going on?
Hey Ben, I'm Jim Schultz. I'm the director of the Democracy Center, and we're in Cochabamba, Bolivia, a place that until about 10 years ago, no one really ever heard of unless they'd memorized Lonely Planet guides. But Cochabamba 10 years ago became this place where people stood up to a foreign corporation, Bechtel, that privatized their water thanks to the Bolivian government and the World Bank, and they kicked Bechtel out. And I think it really inspired people in the world that here was this place, you know, hidden away in Bolivia where you had some of the most humble people on the planet take on one of the most powerful corporations in the world, and David kicked the you-know-what out of Goliath.
So is it a coincidence that we were here this week for the climate conference?
I don't think it is, you know, a coincidence. And I think it's interesting that it's exactly 10 years almost to the day. You know, Bolivia is a little country, but it calls attention to itself because it's symbolic in so many ways. It's the only country in all of the Americas where the majority of the people are indigenous. And since 2006, it's had a president who's indigenous. And I think that calls attention. It was for almost 20 years the laboratory, the most well-known laboratory in the world for the policies of the Washington Consensus and the neoliberal economic model. And then for the last 10 years, it's been a symbol of global resistance to that. And I think that really called a lot of people's attention. And here we are now in 2010, and Bolivia is becoming a symbol of something else global, and that's global climate change. This is a place where climate change is not a theory. This is a place where glaciers are melting, not tomorrow, today. I mean, imagine the experience of living in a community where your family has lived for generations and generations working the land, and this mountain of ice that has been there since before the time of Christ is gone. That calls attention. This is a place that sits on top of lithium, which, you know, the North thinks is going to power their electric Toyota Priuses. So there's a lot of reasons that this country is symbolic, and here we are in Cochabamba for this climate summit.
I was here early enough to catch the water forum before the climate conference, and on the way in, I travelled overland. I noticed we passed over the Rio Grande, and it was basically empty. It's a huge expanse, really wide river. The bridge reminds me of like the Severn Bridge. You spend quite a few minutes going over it, and yet the riverbed was just sand. Is that a symptom of what's going on in Bolivia, or is that kind of an annually normal thing? I've heard about regions of Bolivia which, like, the rivers are all dried up and they have literally no water. And indeed, on the way to the conference site, we passed over three little dried up riverbeds. Is that just the time of year, or is that like a sign of what's going on?
This is the end of the rainy season in Bolivia. And so when rivers are dry now, it's a bad sign. And it's extremely important because this is the area where they want to develop lithium. And lithium requires water. And if there's not any water near now for the people to live on, to grow quinoa, and to sustain communities, what's it going to be like when they start needing it to take lithium out of the ground? These are big environmental questions.
I have a personal vested interest in lithium because I use a lot of electronic gadgets and they're all run on lithium ion batteries.
I thought you were going to say used it for, you know, like bipolar disorder or something.
Well, yeah, that and depression. I mean, that's the two major uses, right?
Some people actually eat the batteries in their wristwatches when they're desperate because of the lithium.
That's interesting. I noticed that a lot of the articles talk about lithium in terms of electric cars, which I find is kind of ironic because it makes it sound like it's a green issue. In fact, one article today, I can't remember whose it was, but somebody's article referred to lithium as an energy source. And it's like, if you're talking about electric cars and a green energy source, it's an incredible amount of ignorance, because what lithium means is the consumer culture for throwaway disposable electronic gadgets, mobile phones, laptops, etc. And Bolivia's sitting on 50% of the world's deposits, apparently.
Well, lithium is not an energy source. It's a device. It's an ingredient to make batteries to store energy. The energy still has to come from somewhere else.
And those batteries don't last forever. Like 3 years is about as much as you expect.
Well, and it's an unproven technology as far as car batteries go. So, you know, look, a lot of people are looking at lithium as a way for Bolivia to lift itself out of poverty. And if Bolivia plays its cards right, it could have a beneficial economic effect for the country. But once again, we're looking at a question of economics versus the environment, and that's a real issue.
In all fairness, though, the lithium deposits are under like a desert which has absolutely zero life. It's a salt plain, which looks really, really beautiful, but nobody lives there. Well, nothing can live there. So you could argue that there's kind of zero social and environmental cost to accessing it.
Well, I'm not sure that environmental damage is related to whether people live on top of the land or next to it, and a lot of people live next to it. They share a water system with it. The Rio Grande River that you're talking about, that's the water system for that region of the world. Quinoa producers depend on it. The two biggest industries in that area are quinoa, which is an environmentally sustainable product, and tourism, which isn't bad. And both of those things are threatened potentially by lithium. So, you know, our position isn't, wow, you shouldn't do it. Our position is, look, go into it with your eyes open about the environmental consequences, recognize them, be real, and see what happens.
So if it was a toss-up between a Japanese multinational having access to the lithium, which is kind of what they're bidding for, or a nationalized industry trying to extract it in a way which was kind of at least sympathetic to kind of social and environmental problems, it seems fairly obvious which the preferred option would be.
Well, unfortunately, you're operating with an assumption that the government here will be fully sensitive to the environmental questions, and that's not completely true.
Which may perhaps bring us to MESA 18, the 18th working group, the unofficial working group at the conference this week. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there were 17 official working groups at the conference. And so a group of indigenous communities and environmental organizations from Bolivia formed what they called MESA 18, MESA 18. And it was one of the most well-attended and powerful of all the groupings. And they took up a lot of domestic Bolivian environmental issues, taking advantage of the opportunity to do that when Evo was trying to draw global attention to himself as Prince Planet. And they basically said, look, you know, La Pachamama right here in Bolivia could use a little more attention.
So Table 18 was excluded from the conference. And one of the things that they were talking a lot about was San Cristobal.
San Cristobal is a mine. It's a zinc and silver mine that's right near the lithium deposits in the Department of Potosí. It's an open pit mine. It's a contamination disaster, particularly for water. And the people of the communities around San Cristobal shut the streets, shut the caminos going to and from the mine to shut the mine down this week on the eve of the summit.
This wasn't a small protest. I heard it was basically the whole community, 900 people out there on the railway line.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was a very large protest.
So how does... do you think the timing was coincidental, or do you think they deliberately timed it to embarrass Evo?
I think they probably deliberately timed it, and I think it was intelligent strategy.
So far, there's been no repression on the protests, and in fact, there was an international solidarity action in London this morning at the offices of the Japanese mining company. Oh, and during the week, the Bolivian foreign minister was quoted as criticizing the company himself. This is the same project which Table 18 wanted to talk about at the conference, which was excluded, and yet, you know, Bolivian officials are talking about it in support of the criticism of the company. So what happens next? You've got a bunch of people who are occupying the mining offices, blocking the mine, and the world's media kind of vaguely interested in Bolivia and the environment at the moment. What's going to happen next week? Are the stormtroopers going to go in and clear the protest?
I can't imagine there's going to be a repression. I think there'll be some sort of agreement to negotiate in a temporary truce.
There was some talk about nationalizing these mining concessions in the past, and that's been off the table. Why is that? Is that still potentially on the cards?
Well, the government has tried to, quote-unquote, nationalize a lot of industries. Where that will go, we really don't know. I mean, the government isn't so much nationalizing things as renegotiating their arrangements and contracts with the multinationals that are involved.
So basically increasing the taxation and allowing them to carry on as usual.
Right. Changing the nature of the partnership, particularly aimed at getting more taxes.
Yeah, I think that kind of brings everyone up to speed on the kind of things that have been going on this week. But for you, how's the conference been, and what do you think of the declaration that's come out of it?
Well, I actually haven't had a chance to read the declaration, but I will. Look, we have a global movement to build, and we don't have a lot of time. We have maybe 10 years to get our act together at most. And my biggest concern is that we need to be strategic and effective, and we need to do it now. We don't have any time to screw around. So I think this conference was a success in terms of getting people together, educating a lot of people, generating a lot of ideas. But a movement needs a very clear set of objectives that everybody can understand what they are. It needs a set of targets that need to be moved in order to achieve those objectives. And it needs a set of action plans that people can participate in. We don't have either of those things. We don't have clear objectives, we don't have clear targets, and we certainly don't have an action plan. I don't think that's the fault of the conference, but I think we should not fool ourselves for an instant that the work of getting our strategy together is done. And like I said, we don't have time to screw around. You know, most of the time when we organize social movements, it would be great to do in 5 years what we end up doing in 10 or 20. This is the only time we've ever had a social movement where there was a deadline. And if we miss that deadline, the world that my 7-year-old daughter is going to grow up in is not a world that I want her to grow up in. We can't even begin to fathom what's going to happen. So this conference is a start, but I think we need to get a lot more serious. I've said this before, and it's something I'll be saying a lot in the next weeks. The words that have rolled around in my head during this meeting come from an important human rights leader from the United States, Martin Luther King, who people revere now, 50 years later, as an important moral leader, but he was a kick-ass strategist, too. And he said, you know, as activists, we need to have soft hearts and hard heads. I think this conference did a lot toward having us communicate with one another in our soft hearts, but we have to have very hard heads now.